Hello, guys. Good afternoon. Hi. Thanks for coming to our session. We really greatly appreciate you guys, the full house. This is the last session of TechEd, and we know you're so eager to go to the keynote, closing keynote. So we'll try to be quick. My name is Vakhtang Nasatra, and I'm Voice TSP, based out of Melbourne. And I've got my colleague, Andrew Zensing, UC Solution Architect. And we'll be presenting Lincoln Enterprise Networks today. We have got just probably some housekeeping. We will be speaking with some of the very Link 2013 specific features today. So we have to show you a disclaimer. And as you understand, Link 2013 preview is out, which means it's a bits and pieces what we're showing and sharing. Some of the concepts we're actually delivering, we just want to tell you actually how things will be working. But the final decision, all the details and confirmations, how features will work, definitely will be available only when Link 2013 will go into general availability. Which also, we have got some giveaways from our partners. So, yes, please ask us questions, but let's keep the sessions at the end. So the plan is we'll run through the presentation content, we'll run through some demonstration content, and then let's allocate a lot of space at the end so we can really not rush through the questions, just have enough time actually to have a good discussion, okay? So what we would like to talk basically today about, what are the basically some troubleshooting and issues you guys facing, and what are the monitoring troubleshooting basically concepts, how we think you should be approaching it, and what we have seen partners and customers doing it. We'll speak about some link media over Wi-Fi networks, and we'll speak about IPv6. And then, yeah, just general questions at the end of the session. How many of you guys, I just want to understand, how many of you have heard about monitoring server? It's great. How many of you deployed and use? Excellent. That's a good idea. So, I mean, if you take the whole concept of I need to troubleshoot link, and it's a broad, it's really broad theme, and we definitely need more than just 1 hour to talk about the whole concept of troubleshooting, because when you're taking the troubleshooting concept of link, it's so many areas actually you can concentrate. It is reading the logs, it is understanding where is a problem coming, is it a device of a client, is it a network, it is a gateway, it is a telco. But what we would like to concentrate and talk very specifically about some quality of service, quality of experience concepts. That what we know, that what really affects media quality when you having a voice conversations is definitely audio-video codec. What sort of codecs do we use, and depending on the codec functionality, it actually drives what sort of experience you will have. Network plays a very important part in that. What kind of delays you have, your delay variation, your packet loss, and how much of the bandwidth you have. And it is very interesting to know that this is probably 2 years in a row we've been delivering quality of service as a topic on our TechEds. And 2 years in a row, I was standing and saying, guys, we need quality of service. We can't ignore it. And every time after those, within the next 12 months, before I hit another ticket, we had customers keep coming and telling us, so Microsoft told us, you know, need quality of service. I'll probably keep repeating myself. Just a clear message, guys, we need quality of service. We can't just live without quality of service. It's a quality of experience, which was a Microsoft concept that we have introduced, is not a substitution for quality of service. And honestly, we decided that we're not going to repeat the whole quality of service concepts. We assume when you deploy link with voice and video modalities on your network, we assume you have done your homework. You have evaluated your network, you've done a network assessment, you actually done network analysis, bandwidth analysis, capacity planning. You've done all these things. We assume you need quality of service. You need layer 2 quality of service. You need layer 3 quality of service. You understand what a DSCP concept is, because we fully support from the link perspective all the markings and all mechanisms, which means if your network team has quality of service domain or model deployed, we will actually follow their recommendations. We will mark the packets appropriately and we'll send them to the network. What we would like to talk about today is more quality of experience. What is the quality of service? Basically, it's not the queuing technology. It's not basically how I implement it. What's important in quality of service is it's important to understand that quality of service is you do to protect your real-time traffic inside your network. That's why you do quality of service. Why you do quality of experience, how it fits the picture. Basically, quality of experience helps you to protect your real-time traffic during a network changes in the network conditions. I'll give you a very simple example. You can have a great quality of service inside your network. And you can say, great, I more or less have around 2-3% of packet loss or 5% packet loss. It's great. But imagine if you're going to have 5% packet loss during the first second of your conversation or 2 seconds of conversation. It's not good because that's a changing network condition. So you would expect your packet loss supported during your conversation. So this is where the quality of service, quality of experience come into play. It constantly measures the network, and based on the network feedback, it's the various things happening in the background. So quality of experience, I'll give you the concept. We follow the standard. How many of you heard about RTCP protocol? Okay, RTCP protocol is a protocol that has been defined to run in parallel to RTP, to real-time media, and to let endpoints to constantly measure and monitor network performance. It's a delay variation, and the packet loss, and the various things actually monitored. It's interesting, every voice conversation, for example, takes up 2 ports. Why it is 2 ports? Because number one, even ports usually allocated for your RTP streams, and next higher port, which is an odd port, actually used by RTCP protocol to communicate and measure your network. So every voice call takes 2 ports. So every link client that runs on your IP phone, which is long phone edition, it can be client running on your computer, your mediation server, your conferencing server, everywhere we actually collect statistics about the call. Once call is completed, what is happening actually? The clients generate, it analyzes all collected data, generate around 4 kilobytes file, roughly it is around 4K file, and sends to front-end server. And then front-end server actually associates that QoS sort of quality of experience statistics and puts into the database, into the SQL server. This is basically how it works. And plus we, in addition to the two very call-specific that data, we also present customer, basically our users with various warnings. If there are some problems on the network or if it's a poor wireless network connection, we basically keep telling. The whole important point is manage users' expectation. If he's going to have some bad network, he'd better tell him so user is prepared. How it actually works with 2010? We have a monitoring server role, and basically quality of experience data is collected. It's sent to the front-end server. Front-end server does all this magic. It's assigns, and it uses MSMQ to push down to the monitoring server, and the monitoring server places data into SQL database. The QoS reports sent, the messages are sent as a SIP service request from the endpoints to front-end server. What's happened with 2013? We've removed the monitoring server role. So what we are doing now, monitoring server running, it's no longer as a server. It's just a role running on a front-end server, monitoring and archiving. And we're no longer using the message queuing. We're using, I think it's unified agent, basically, which runs on a front-end server that collects the data, sorts it out, and then sends data to SQL database. So you don't need monitoring server anymore by itself as a dedicated server, but you will need SQL database to actually store this data. So what kind of stuff we collect? We collect all sorts of statistics. We collect endpoint statistics, who is it connected, IP addresses, we calculate mean opinion score, we calculate network performance, all the deal healer, and most of the, I would say, boring part was if someone's doing desktop sharing, that wasn't really collected in 2010. So what we are doing in 2013, we're introducing various modalities. Into the video, for example, we're adding this capability to do stereo, capability to do H.264 codec. And also now with 2013, you will have capability to run multiple video sessions into your client. So since we've introduced all those changes, so there is definitely some changes actually coming to the QoE metrics on a link end. Oops, do I have them? No. So there are some various different metrics. We're measuring additional variables on the video end. If you have 5 sessions coming to link, then we will report 5 different metrics. You will know each of the session actually what it is happening. We'll give you more statistics on the audio. The most important, which is I'm really excited, we're now telling you what's happening with your application sharing. Actually, you can report and I'll show you the example. So how it really helps you to troubleshoot network? I usually say we can't tell you it's a mandatory because it's really optional role to deploy. But we're very, very highly recommending to, if you ever going to think about deploying any voice communications for Link, always try to deploy a monitoring server because the monitoring server role is really your eyes into the Link network. It's eyes into your network to tell you what it is happening with your environment. So troubleshooting, that should be your first call. I have a problem, let me have a look. You just made the call, I would like to see what was your experience, because user who placed the call have no idea. Was it the packet loss or what's happened? And in case if you are not monitoring network, user would call you and tell you, I just had a bad experience on the call. How are you going to find out? Because that network event already happened, it's gone. Someone just stormed and broadcast it. You don't know what it is. You can't really go back and recreate that you had a massive delay. Possibly you're hoping that your network guys are monitoring network, hoping. But again, you're relying on some external sources to do various monitoring, and then you're going to have a task of how I'm going to map those various events together to give me some clear picture actually what's happened with the call. It also gives you capability to be more proactive. I call it active and proactive. Actively, you can be working with your monitoring server reports, with the data that sits inside monitoring server, to basically do some planning, basic planning. I have a remote site, users are using mostly voice, I'm okay with the bandwidth, and suddenly users start complaining, I can go and see, hey, I'm doing more video. Then I have to do something else. So it's a more active planning, and at the same time, proactive, I would say, if you're running a SCOM, you can run synthetic transactions. How many of you guys know what synthetic transaction is? Okay. So basically, through the SCOM engine, what you can tell Link, you can schedule some false calls. So the Link actually will place some test calls to various places inside your network and actually will return you statistics on actually what was happened during a call. It failed or it didn't fail or was a problem. And based in case if there are some thresholds or exceeds, then it will report you and tell you you've got a massive packet loss in various areas of your network. So again, it is you being more proactive. So honestly, what I want to do, rather than show you the slides that various reports can do, I probably would like to go and show you actually what we are doing. So what we've done, we have Link server running right here downstairs. All the demo environment running off that Link server. We're making a lot of calls. All these days we've been making calls and all this data was actually collected. So what I just want to give you some sense of what, if you've seen it, it's great. If you haven't seen it, it's a good benefit to tell you basically how much of the data can be collected. Right. So when you deploy a monitoring server, basically it will turn on automatically recording of this quality of experience data into your SQL database. It's then, in order to come up with those sort of reports that predefined by and created by Microsoft, you need to deploy monitoring server reports. This is running on SQL reporting services. Now, is it means this is the only thing I can use? Of course, no. SQL, the database is open for you. It is a SQL database, and then you can just use your imagination and actually start writing your queries and actually query the data, be more proactive. For example, some of the customers I'm working, what they are doing, they've defined certain thresholds that's critical to their network. I think they're doing any packet loss more than 10%, any delays more than 200 milliseconds. And they basically, at the end of the day, they're writing just the query, which is stored procedure inside SQL. It says, go to the database, have a look at the last past 24 hours, and tells me if I have met those values of packet loss and delay. If something have happened, then I can actively go and understand actually, is it normal behavior or not? Because losing a packet may be a normal behavior because of various things like a bad link or ADSL link or someone coming across the internet. Okay? So just use your imagination and the business requirements, then on top of this you can overlay whatever you want to create. But let's say basically I'm a help desk user and basically I'm sitting on this on my help desk and someone calls me and says, I'm Vakhtang, I had a problem with my code. So basically, the next obvious steps, what I would be doing, I just need to reload, sorry guys, just need to come into this place. I'll run a user activity report. And user activity report basically will tell me specifying time frame, and I just need to say, Alice. I've placed a couple of calls for Alice, so I've got a lot of data stored. So this will give you me idea what actually has happened during this specific period, the activity by this user, Alice. As you can see, it defines whenever Alice placed a call, and that was a video and audio call. Alice placed a call to Vakhtang, and this was Alice then received those various calls from Vakhtang. Okay? Then you can, as a user of the help desk, I'll say, well, hello, tell me, When you had a problem, you can really pin down and say, this is the time when I had a problem. Then you can select this very specific time. Oops. Let's say this was a video call. Then you can drill down into every call, which tells you your pool, Alice is running, the time of the call, and it tells you some of the basic SIP messages. If I really would like to dig in and say, how did she finish the conversation? What sort of services? Which means I no need to go and say, hey, can you please enable logging on your client, place a call, collect the logs, and tell me. First of all, you can do that sort of stuff, but hey, the event's gone already. That loss happened. The actions actually is moved on. Network now is good. So if the person does it, she may not necessarily replicate the problem. So you may see some of the messages, and for example, if I go to the service message, it gives me basically what's happened. Request was proxies. Basically, this is, it tells me that she was getting inbound routing call. This was part of call establishment. Then in this case, when Alice says, look, I had some problems with hearing with the media, I couldn't hear, was a choppy voice or something else, then you can go into the media quality report. Remember, we said when the endpoints drop the line, when they finish conversation, a lot of data is calculated and coming to the front-end server. So it is sitting on the server itself. And then you can drill down and say, okay, Alice was caller, she made a call to Vakhtang. Very important. Imagine if you rolled out Link and you gave everyone, one of our sponsors, headsets, which are certified to work with Link, which means they optimized to work with Link. And imagine is that she was telling this was a very bad audio. And imagine that you can see she was running, it's basically from the TechEd PC using a Link client, was going to Link client. And then at the end, you can see what sort of device is being connected. And if you're not recognizing some of the device user is using, then it's an obvious question of, well, what kind of device you use? Oh, I just come off the Virgin flight. I was using that headset. Well, that's a behavior. That's what I used to do, actually. I used to do before I got one of these. So it tells you this kind of capability. Then it actually defines what sort of computer she is coming, what sort of client it is used, tells you the operating system, the CPU, and the most importantly, it tells you some stats about your call. Let me
close down to the color info. Yeah, here we go. It tells you the codec was used.
Now, it's a Link 2013 preview we're running. Don't be disturbed with some of the stats that she's not using 26 meg. Guys, this is preview, okay? There's no way you're going to do 26 meg on this network today.
So it gives you an idea of it is MSRT audio. That was the codec. And then it tells you the jitter and tells you the packet loss.
So immediately, just drilling into this report, you already ruled probably half of the functionality, half of the time you would spend trying to figure out what's happened. And this is related exactly to the time when call was happening. And then if you have a lot of packet loss, you probably should pick up a phone and tell your network, guys, you've got a problem.
I would add in, too, you're looking at a lot of detail, right? As you're scrolling down, you saw several pages of information. So you might wonder, well, wow, it's nice, Microsoft, you provide all this information. But at the end of the day, how do I know that, for example, max round trip time of 72 milliseconds is good or bad, or my packet loss rate or my MAS scores, for example? These are all good numbers. We know that because they're not highlighted in yellow or red. If any of these numbers start to deviate from what we know a good audio call or a good video call will be like, we'll start to highlight that with yellow or red in the background. You can hover over that to get additional information as to why or what those ranges are. So it's not a matter of, okay, let's scroll through and actually compare each one of these numbers to the range. We're already doing that in the reporting system. That makes it much easier when you're scrolling down to see the potential some of the factors that were causing that poor audio quality experience.
And that kind of information we can generate for you if you're proactively looking at the link in, for example, media quality summary reports. Again, some of it we're pre-populating. It tells you this is what it is. Then it tells you got a problem.
Which means once you come to these sort of portals, as Andrew mentioned, it's immediately flagging you, hey, you start looking at this.
In the previous media report, do you list the UDP number?
Ports?
Yes, absolutely.
Was it that?
Yes.
No,
it tells you the... hold on. It tells you... here. It was hooking at the server edge port.
It's a multiple legs. This call was done through the multiple legs, that's why. I just don't want to bore you guys going one by one. I'm giving you the concept. If you had, as I said, if you had multiple calls, for example, you can have you going to gateway and gateway going to SIP trunk or normal trunk, then you will have two sets of reports. As one report, you going to gateway, and then another set of reports with the call, gateway calling SIP trunk. And let me show you.
I should have it. Give me a second. I have done a call.
While you're looking at that one, I saw one other question that we had in the back as well.
Can you tune the report to a degree so that if you know you've got a higher latency?
Could you modify some of those thresholds, for example? The question is, can you modify the thresholds if you know that some of your links are going to exceed some of those ranges or tolerances? I don't know. That's a good. Do you know that one?
No,
an excellent question. We'll put that on the list.
We had a lot of customers ask us that question. They would like to modify those. No, it was opposite. They would like us to tell them what are those. Our response was, well, this is what we believe in average, and it may really depend on customer because various customers run different networks. You may have those thresholds working well on your gigabit Ethernet network, which is everywhere, but may not be good to someone who is running ADSL links at every remote site. So they really depend. I don't think so you can.
So this is a call, for example. I just want to show you the different legs. I have placed the call to my mobile. And basically, under the media quality, it basically gives you every leg. And the way it gives you every leg, if you have five people dialing to you, you will see actually, you can go drill down and see every leg. Do you have to do it? Well, it depends. It depends what is your goal, how much do you want to dig into that. But the stats is already there.
So this tells you mediation server information, mediation server leg. For example, let me see. Yeah, here we go.
it tells you that this was my IP, and we've been speaking to Edge, and it's, I don't know why it's keep bouncing through the Edge, but it tells you the mediation server leg, and then it tells you what actually mediation server was talking to my net phone. And it tells you basically I've hit the mediation server, then mediation server hit actually my net phone, on the, and this was statistics. As you can see, important thing is this is difference. Mediation server generated various stats. My net phone did not. Well, of course, because they not. So the only link clients and devices generate these stats. It's a very specific process they generate. Okay? Oh, I'll go back to presentation. Where am I?
One of the answers to the first couple questions, right? So the first question that we had earlier was, can you modify the thresholds? You cannot modify the thresholds in the built-in reports, but all those reports are in SQL Reporting Server, which you could copy and then modify your own custom version of that, which would be the other one. I think that's leading to your question as well. So the reports are all in SQL. We actually worked with the SQL Reporting Services folks in Link Server 2010 and 2013 to try to build some of that automation in there. Excuse me, sorry. But if you have people with expertise around Excel analysis services or SQL reporting services, you can create any number of custom reports off the data sets in SQL as well.
Okay. So let's move on, guys. Link media over Wi-Fi. Quick question. How many of you guys running Link 2010 over Wi-Fi networks? Excellent. The only time I really... I run most of the time over Wi-Fi. The only time I come to wired network when I have to reimage my PC. It's the nature of the beast. The good news I have, well, it's kind of, it explains, you know. Yeah. So, it's a data center.
Looks like someone's building a fort almost, right?
Yeah. So the bad news I have for the 2010 users running over Wi-Fi network, I can push it back, take the photo. It's fine. you can download those presentations, guys. They're going to be available. So the bad news I have is that Wi-Fi is not supported. If you call Microsoft and say, I'm running over Wi-Fi network, well, it's not supported by us. It's a best effort. We'll tell you, well, tough luck. Although 70% of Microsoft... 70% of Microsoft people in Melbourne office, for example, we all run on wireless. Although it is best effort, but hey, that's my expectation. I don't expect it to be high good quality because I'm on a wireless network. What we have done with 2010, and this is... I have to be careful. I'll draw the line. What I'm going to be speaking now about Wi-Fi is something that's going to come with 2013. So from one end, what we're doing, we're working with the wireless vendors to make sure when Link runs over Wi-Fi networks, it actually handles media a little bit differently. So the goal is actually when Link 2013 is released to give you the white papers, which is non-vendor specific, which will be hopefully part of your planning tool, actually, which will describe this is how actually you need to run your Wi-Fi networks. Non-vendor specific, generically say, adjust and do various things to make sure Link actually runs successfully. So with 2013, we'll be supported. Again, disclaimer, when it is released, is going to be the final details. Okay? And one of the major push was to the fact is most of those mobile devices coming actually Wi-Fi enabled only. Well, slates and all these devices only can do Wi-Fi. They really can't get wireless, wired connection, okay? So why Wi-Fi network is a problem? There's various reasons for that. It's a shared media, a lot of interference. You've got overlapping channels, only three of them, so you sometimes want to run away from 2.4 gigahertz, and then you go to 5, but it's sort of, it's good, but more channels, but it's a less coverage area. The whole point is, once you run Wi-Fi networks, they were not really designed to do real-time media.
So what we see now, for example, Aruba, these guys are running with the specific recommendations already they have. I think they published, isn't it? They have recommendation if you're going to run Link 2010, this is the way you need to design your Wi-Fi networks. Okay?
I was going to add in one of the bullet points there, the small one right around device driver issues. Oops. On this one. The difference that we see there, so we've been doing a lot of troubleshooting, right, as we go to add Wi-Fi support into Link Server 2013. And it's this slide kind of covers a slew of issues that we cover, right? One of the ones that was interesting to me that I had heard on the device driver side is the driver itself is relatively important. For example, you might be connected to a wireless base station. Your driver, if it's a poorly written driver, will actually drop you once a minute to rescan to see if there's another base station or frequency, right? And so literally, that drop, if it's occurring once a minute, for example, in some cases is 200 or 300, 400 milliseconds. And so you're seeing just a regular packet loss occurring because the driver itself is saying, stop, okay, rescan, see if there's another better access point that I can see. Better drivers will do an interleaved approach where they'll start scanning on a different channel versus a channel that you're currently connected on. And so the range is not just, like we said, other wireless mediums, right, that might be conflicting with the actual EMF itself, but even down to the driver capabilities of some of the ones. So we're trying to work with all the partners who support wireless technologies, right? We mentioned both the Wi-Fi access point capabilities, but also at the desktop or laptop device driver level to make sure that some of those driver issues don't occur for that.
Because one of the recommendations we'll cover in the slides later, you no longer can actually afford just buy the laptop and rely on the wireless to connect to network. Now you probably need to think, well, if I'm going to buy a laptop, what the laptop should be, what kind of hardware should be, is it going to have two antennas? All these things actually you need to start considering because you know you're going to run Link on them. So basically, once 2013 is released, we'll publish the white paper, which will give you more in-depth details. But this is just to give you the feelings actually in which direction we're working. On a hardware level, we'll definitely recommend you basically to take concurrent dual band APs. And basically, coming back to the point, what sort of laptops you buy, what are the drivers, as Andrew mentioned, and how many antennas, what it is, it's very important actually. You consider those factors. User usage is also another important factor. You kind of have nomadic users who will pick up a laptop, for example, and will go into conference room and sit the whole conference room in one place. He will be on a wireless network. That's a kind of one usage, which kind of drives your Wi-Fi design, but at the same time, Wi-Fi is a shared media, but it also drives the behavior, actually, what's going to happen with the link traffic running in that zone. At the same time, your mobile users, for example, forget about laptop. Once 2013 is out, what we're telling you, you're going to have a mobile in the office running on the Wi-Fi, running the link client, doing over Wi-Fi, you can talk and walk. Walk and talk. Talk and walk. Which one is right? Walk and talk.
Assuming you can do both. And chew gum.
So once you're doing that, exercise. You can pass various points. And what we're finding, the AP handover was really another different process. Once you're actually going from one AP to another, some actually devices with enterprise authentication, you have to go and authenticate with every AD, with every access point. So fast authentication is one of the mechanisms basically we recommend to consider. Wireless LAN controllers is one of them we recommend to consider. Wireless multimedia, which is a kind of a standard these days, comes even with the home-based routers. If you have like a D-Link, Netgear, those routers, you turn on, you can see wireless multimedia even implemented in those devices. You need to consider and start thinking about these sort of capabilities. And again, depend where you are. For home users, you will have a different requirements. For office users, will have, of course, different requirements. And most of the home users we've seen, people would consider, great, get your wireless router. It's likely you're not going to do handovers. You'll get your connections, turn on wireless multimedia. I've seen customer, actually, who was pushing his enterprise network down to his employees into the wireless. He was actually deploying his wireless points and doing various things to make sure employees get into his wireless. Look, there is a variety of the ways and things people do. So think about all these possibilities. And the hotspots, don't expect to come with the iPad into McDonald's and try to run link presentation or receive it. Because I tried once. Apparently, I was traveling. I was traveling between Melbourne and Canberra, and once before you leave Victoria, there is a BP probably 150 kilometers between before the border, and there is a McDonald's, and they've got the great coffee on the whole path, actually, Melbourne to Canberra. That's great, the great coffee. And it's free Wi-Fi, and then suddenly I had to get connected. I tried to connect. Well, nah, it doesn't work. So, again, the requirement drives behavior of the users, what they will do, okay? It's a different world. So, I'll pass now to Andrew, and we'll cover the IPv6.
Oh, yeah, right, the different clicker. I've been playing with the presenter one. All right, so that's the quality of experience, right, and the concept of Wi-Fi. As you can see, there's some technical challenges right around Wi-Fi that we're kind of working through to provide that guidance of how to support Wi-Fi with Link Server 2013. Actually, internally, I think one of the things we've done on the home routers is our IT group has kind of done some testing, and so now we have a list of recommended home routers and access points, right, for people to use if they want to connect over Wi-Fi at home. So we envision, right, being able to publish guidance around that that says here's the specs and things you should look for, provide those to your end users, and they'll have a better mobile or home-connected experience if they're working from home. The other, the net new change, right, is that we've had a lot of requests and feedback from customers around IPv6 support for our server family of products. We actually have a development process internally called Common Criteria, and the Common Criteria specifies what is mandatory in each one of our products. And so this is obviously something to get on that list. It's relatively important. IPv6 made that a year or two back as we realized that that's going to be a requirement. For a Microsoft product to ship and not have support for that Common Criteria, the vice president of that division must, you know, explain in writing to the Common Criteria board why their product is shipping without that. So we have a couple slides, right, to kind of show you why the prevalence of IPv6. You're all aware that we're running out of, we've ran out of addresses to hand out to ISPs, right? So internet growth obviously has grown over time, but the real factor is if you look at the address blocks, the last one was handed out over a year ago. And so we are no longer able to hand out from the internet governing bodies the concept of address blocks which contain IPv4 addresses. There are still organizations and there are ISPs which have IPv4 addresses, right? So we haven't exhausted it down to the point of provisioning to an organization or an end user level, but there are no more. We can't go back to the pool and magically envision some more IPv4 addresses. And so realizing that this was coming down the pipe, about 15 years ago or so, the work started on the concept of the next generation protocol for IP, known commonly as IPv6. And so with IPv6, we have some capabilities or some large number of addresses, essentially, that allow us to manage past this concept of the exhaustion of IPv4 addresses. Meanwhile, before the IPv6 essentially is adopted everywhere, right, from Windows devices to tablets to mobile devices to your computing systems and server platforms, there's been a lot of sort of transitory technologies that have been deployed. Some of those, for example, actually have some negative connotations when we start running voice over those platforms, such as some of the higher-end carrier-grade NATs. For example, in the U.S., your mobile device or your phone essentially coming from a carrier does not have a public IP address, but it's coming in with a NATed address. And you can imagine with tens of millions or, you know, essentially hundreds of millions of devices that are prevalent on these networks. The concept of that carrier-grade NAT means that we're going to lose some of the bandwidth and or presentation capabilities from that device in terms of having a fully qualified IP address. There's some additional points there, right? The big one, and I was trying to remember the quote before the session. I should have looked it up, actually. But the one that kind of sunk home for me of how many IPv6 addresses there are is that If you look at the Earth's surface, every area the size of the pin, there's enough room for 1 million IPv6 addresses, right? And so the number of addresses by doubling the address space in IPv6 is enough that we see for the foreseeable future. We expect IPv6 essentially to be able to, live for decades on as the computing environment and the internet infrastructure begins its migration to IPv6. Out of curiosity, did anyone here participate in IPv6 Day earlier this year? So if you weren't aware, right, several of the large internet sites in the U.S. decided to test IPv6 by turning off their IPv4 functionality and lighting up IPv6 capabilities back in June. There was some trepidation, right, kind of coming up in advance of how that's going to work as we manage running websites such as Facebook and Google and Hotmail, et cetera, on IPv6 versus IPv4, but it essentially kind of went off without a hitch. And so we anticipate a couple more of those over the next couple years. We saw some feedback and error conditions from that. Those can be tuned, for example. And so we see this natural progression from IPv4 to IPv6 being something that's going to take time going forward. During this transitory time from IPv4 to IPv6, we have some transition technologies. The reason for this is that the header information on an IPv4 and an IPv6 packet are completely different. Meaning by that, if I take an IPv6 packet and drop it onto an IPv4 network, it's going to be rejected, vice versa. Right? We cannot just interoperate by dropping some IPv6 addresses on the network and having them follow our routed IPv4 infrastructure. And so we have this concept of these transition technologies. We list a couple for you. There's the ISOTAP one in Teredo. ISOTAP is kind of what we use in the Windows 7 and Windows 8 capabilities. This essentially allows the devices to tunnel or transit their IPv6 packets over an IPv4 backbone, so enabling you to deploy both or have this concept of 4 and 6 deployed concurrently and have that deployed around. 6-to-4 is one that's typically used at the carrier level. They're using this in that concept of mobile device spaces in other areas. But essentially, these concepts of ISOTAP, Teredo, and 6-to-4 allow you to have this capability of deploying both IPv6 address devices and IPv4 address devices while you go through and upgrade your network end-to-end to ensure native routing for those IPv6 packets from both an internal perspective and an external perspective as you get those IPv6 addresses from your ISP. The rationale around link, we mentioned this concept of common criteria. We are seeing a large demand, specifically in the Asia-Pacific region, actually, around requiring software products to support IPv6 natively to be authorized for that company's approved purchase, for example. They're starting to, because of the address depletion, specifically around Asia, at a higher rate than it has been throughout the rest of the world. The U.S. was fortunate enough to have a lot of organizations that have Class A and Class B addresses, and so therefore we haven't seen some of that exhaustion yet in the U.S. as in other areas worldwide. That customer base here, though, has pushed back to Microsoft saying, we need IPv6 in the product. And so knowing that the address space is going away, knowing that it's on our common criteria, was kind of some of the driving factors to ensuring that we have the concept of IPv6 support in link. We also anticipate, considering that we're doing development in the 2011 and 2012 timeframe for link, but we understand that most customers adopting link server 2013 will probably be doing that in the 14, 15, 16 timeframe, right? And so in looking forward, into the crystal ball as best as we can do, we anticipate a much wider adoption of things like tablets and mobile devices in that adoption timeframe. And so knowing that, the increased number of those devices, the combination of the carrier movements towards IPv6, the requests from the regions that are running out of IPv4 addresses, right, has made it mandatory really inside of Link to do that. We had evaluated looking at IPv6 in the Link 2010 timeframe, but IPv6 represented some significant engineering challenges. Link has a lot of work around our codecs and our negotiation on audio and video and desktop sharing, the concept of edge and firewall transversal using protocols like ICE and STUN and TURN that we've essentially developed and tuned over a period of 10 years, right? And so moving that entire platform to a completely restructured protocol level was a significant amount of engineering effort. We did not get that completed in the 2010 timeframe, but that is something, right, that we're now shipping as part of Link Server 2013. As we looked at baking or including support for IPv6 into the Link 20 Server 13 product, we had some kind of design principles that we wanted to lay out and ensure all the developers followed. First one is it should be relatively simple, right? We don't expect or we don't want that to be a manual process where you're having to install some sort of coexistence or manage that. You should be able to just have these servers be addressed with an IPv4 or IPv6 or both, right, from the OS level, and the application itself is able to consume or leverage those with minimal configuration from the administrator or the operator. We also want to make sure we have that coexistence, so we know that our Link Server 2013 clients must also communicate with Link 2010, our OCS 2007 R2 clients, as well as all of the gateways, IP PBXs, session border controllers, and other infrastructure that's around there. So in terms of requiring or, you know, having a IPv6 address support, we want to make sure that we're also not blocking communications with those legacy versions who don't have that IPv6 capabilities. So goals, right, is, but also at the same time saying it's not supposed to be something that we require IPv4 on your Link infrastructure for IPv6 to work. If you were in an organization that went pure native IPv6, Link 2013 should support that as well. So not only do we want to support the organizations that have the coexistence approach, but we, especially in the next couple of years, right, we anticipate that there will be organizations that will be a native IPv6 organization, and we expect Link to work in that native or pure IPv6 environment as well. So goals, right, is to both support the transitory period of coexistence of 4 and 6, as well as that pure IPv6 capability for orgs that choose to do that. When we're looking at the concept of running Link over IPv6, we really kind of have four major areas of investment or areas of planning to look at. One is around signaling. And so with signaling, we have the question, do we use IPv4, IPv6? What is our preference? So as we're pointing out here, right, client to server, we don't have a preference there. That's really up to the individual client. We understand that some of the clients, right, will probably be running non-Microsoft operating systems. We have no control over what that operating system prefers at the network stack level. So when we run the Link client on top of that other operating system, if it chooses to send IPv6 signaling, we'll respect it. If it chooses to send IPv4 signaling, we'll respect that. We do, however, have control on server-to-server communication. We run and manage the OS. That happens to be the guys in the next building, right? So we're able to kind of work with them to see how that works. The rationale and the reason we prefer version V4 instead of V6 for server-to-server is our expectation is that for organizations that have both, 4 and 6, that the IPv4 network infrastructure is very robust. People have deployed and managed and monitored their network environment. They know their routing tables. They know the paths, right? We're going to expect a consistent response when we drop IPv4 packets on the network. As people are adding IPv6 support to their network, what we're seeing is that that IPv6 support is less robust, right? It may be in certain buildings or regions, on certain subnets, but not others. Not all of those routing issues and routing tables have been addressed yet. Some of them might be uncovered by having us preferring IPv6 signaling. And so by preferring 4 instead of 6, if you have that mixed environment, we're assuming that the 4 path will be consistent because we don't have that same level of guarantee or service that the 6 path would be consistent. For media, same concept. If you have mixed, we'll prefer 4 over 6. Same rationale. We expect that 4 network to be much more well understood in terms of routing and access and firewall rules compared to the 6 network, which the company might be just investing or kind of coming up to speed on. Servers, we have a setting in the central management store which will allow you to enable or disable IPv6. So as an admin, if you want to turn it off, you're welcome to go in and check the box. If you leave it turned on and your server infrastructure has IPv6 addresses on there, we're able to leverage either 4 or 6 using that sort of preferred approach we outlined prior. The clients, right, will prefer media over 4, same rationale as before. But we'll leave it up to the client itself for signaling. We don't have a preference for that signaling path, whether it's IPv4 or IPv6. In terms of capabilities, we also wanted to give you the overview that IPv6 will be supported for all of our major link modalities, right? So we'll be able to do instant messaging, peer-to-peer, voice, video, app sharing, file transfer, all of these either using native IPv6, native IPv4, or an org that's in a mixed 4 and 6 environment. Same for conferencing, audio, video, app sharing, file transfer, whiteboard, all functionality, again, 4 and 6 capable or enabled. Edge, we've also done the work around Edge to enable this concept of provisioning Edge with both 4 and 6. So all of our AV, IM presence, data collaboration capabilities on Edge are available with either one of the protocol stacks or both protocol stacks enabled on the host, as well as all of our manageability tools. So link server control panel, right, planning tool, topology builder, the CDR and QoE reports that you saw demoed a few moments earlier, all these are also capable with 4 and 6. Actually, I was, you know, thinking about that. Do you know if the lab infrastructure has V6 addresses in it? I know I don't know if you guys noticed that, but in the license agreement for wireless, it notes that you're provisioned with both a 4 and a 6 address here on your devices. So if you plug into the TechNet network or you get a wireless address, you'll notice that both are provisioned.
In a lab, we have another lab on my laptop, actually, which is completely running Link 2013 or IPv6. The problem is my drivers are crashed, and we can't show you completely running, so I'm not in a server mode.
Oh, no problem. But I wasn't sure if I was going to say we'd be able to pull up one. If it was in the other lab, right, we're able to go into the COE reports and actually see, QoE reports, and actually see those 4 and 6 addresses and which one was used for signaling, which one was used for media, for example, and see that it kind of followed the platforms behind that. Same for platforms, right, our concept of the link clients running on the mobile and tablet and Slate devices will support that concept of 4 and 6 endpoints coming in from those areas as well. We do have some interop scenarios that you should be aware of. So we talked about this concept of IPv4, dual stack, right, or an IPv6 only site. Obviously, if we're an IPv6 only site, we're not going to be able to talk to any V4 clients, down-level link clients, which don't have support for IPv6, but also we don't talk to the dual stack clients because of that preference around IPv4 first. If we have IPv6 only at the server side, then we need to be IPv6 only at the client side as well. If we are running dual stack, we have support then for Link Server 2013 and both IPv4 and our dual stack 2013 IPv6 clients. The other area outside of Link is that once, as you go through this concept of, okay, Link Server 2013 now supports the capability of IPv6, great, let's go and address our Windows servers and our client subnets and provide IPv6 capabilities, but there's also the concept or the planning area around the stuff outside of Link, right? So at some point in time, we're also going to have to look at our PSTN gateways, our session border controllers, for example, or our SIP trunk providers, and see what their support capabilities are around IPv6. We've announced support for IPv6 earlier to all of our partners today that go through the UCOIP, or the Unified Communications Open Interoperability Program, and we've started the process of allowing them or, you know, working with them to set up what that test matrix will look like. So as those vendors add IPv6 support, we're able to go through and certify it from both a 4 perspective and or a 6 perspective. So you'll see which devices are certified from to work with Link, and specifically which protocol stacks were used in that certification path. So we've added the concept of IPv6 support to UCOIP, and you'll see over time products being recertified or updating their certification as they add IPv6 support to include that in those non-link components or devices on the network as well. The final one is around our edge pools. So obviously we have the concept of our edge pools and front-end pools, right? If we're native IPv6, we have to be native at both the edge and the front-end pool layer. If we're dual stack, both the edge server and the front-end server can communicate with four only, both at dual stack, or only V6 enabled at both sides. So again, pretty clear, right? If I'm not running a dual stack IPv6 at the edge, I'm not going to be able to communicate with a V4 or a dual stack client that's running on the front end server, because it's going to prefer IPv4 for signaling. It's not going to be aware that that edge pool has only IPv6 support unless the front end pool is only IPv6, in which case its only choice is to use IPv6, which will talk then to that edge pool running IPv6 as well. For internal and external, similar concepts. As long as we're running native IPv4, we're good. If we're running dual stack, we're good with four or a dual stack. And IPv6, we're currently going through our certification process there for our edge server coexistence in a pure native IPv6 environment. So with that, we've given you the updates for Link Server 2013 from a quality of experience. So some of the changes there are the additional attributes that we're capturing in those quality of experience areas. The big one would be application sharing, for example, as well as some of the new features like HD video and some of the FEC capabilities, stereo audio, for example, that we've announced as part of those protocols. We also covered the concept of Wi-Fi, so what the changes are coming around the support stance there. Hopefully we've enlightened you a little bit about some of the technical challenges you'll face. So as we release our support for Wi-Fi, we're also going to be calling out some of the infrastructure changes we'll recommend or might even require, for example, for that Wi-Fi support or for that Wi-Fi experience to be supported. And then finally, we highlighted the changes around IPv6, showing you kind of the rationale of why we've made the investment there, as well as what that IPv6 support looks like in terms of Link Server 2013. So with that, related content, these sessions are, so I actually was talking to the lady posting the slides. I thought they were posting them next week. They're actually posting them each day. So you're welcome to start downloading the sessions from Wednesday and Thursday already. These should be posted up this evening sometime. They'll definitely then be available by next week. The recordings themselves are going out to Channel 9. She said that's going to be maybe a week or two before the recordings are available, but you'll then be able to watch any of the sessions that you may have missed. If you're looking for the quick overview, the architecture session, we announced sort of all the new changes. Meeting improvements was mostly a demo of the Link client and hosting, essentially, or creating, having an ad hoc and a scheduled Link meeting experience. Ewan and I covered the deployment. And we ran out of time in that session, but that does have some slides around the migration path and migration options from R2 in 2010 to Link Server 2013. There was a customer panel and the voice improvement session yesterday. And this morning, there was the Link PBX session, as well as the enterprise networking one that we just completed. We invite you to go out and download Exchange 2013 preview and Link 2013 preview. These are publicly available. If you're curious to see some of these features, we have walkthroughs that help you set that up or build that in a lab environment. So thank you for coming out. We're going to remind you to fill out your evals. And let's try to get these giveaways set up. So you want to do you guys like the random approach? All right. Let's do some gambling.
Excuse me, is there going to be questions?
Oh, sorry.
The freebies. Yeah,
yes, there are. It's hard to there's so many of those closing slides. I forgot to put they put all the mandatory ones in, but usually the last slide says questions, and that triggers our head to ask for questions. So let's go questions.
First of all, do you support Wireshark?
Do we
in Wireshark, you know, you can capture RTP streams.
Yep.
You do G711, you can.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that the majority of people who troubleshoot Link use Wireshark as their protocol analyzer. Microsoft folks are not allowed to use Wireshark because of some unclear so Wireshark does some decryption of certain algorithms or certain codecs, which I think legally it's unclear as to whether that's allowed or not, and we're not supposed to. But that doesn't mean that you can't, you know, if your legal group says it's authorized or you feel that's okay, you're welcome to use Wireshark too. That's the only rationale as to why we don't, right? It's not a technical limitation or hurdle.
On the media servers, you know, the transcoding and everything is done by the CPU, actual CPUs. So what is the CPU utilization we should be looking for?
Yep, okay, so question is, right, so you're deploying, so if you saw the architecture, right, we've moved the AV MCU onto the front-end server role. We no longer have the option in 2013 to break that out dedicated. And so the question is, what kind of CPU utilization might you expect as you run things like HD video conferencing, right, web sharing, large meetings, everything else? My feedback on that is that when we do our server sizing guidance, which is draft material now, right, but as you go through a planning tool exercise or look at TechNet closer to RTM, we will have this concept of user profile saying if you run this many users with a mix of this many IM sessions, this many meetings, everything else, our target server CPU utilization with that load is 72%, right, or 72% or so. So running at that expected mix would be in that 70%-ish range. The reason for 70 is that we run at 70 because there are activities that will occur periodically that will cause it to spike. If we run higher, that like 85 or 90, when we go to do that spike, CPU is not available, you'll see some sort of activity or user disruption. So we usually target around 70% utilization.
Yep.
NetPat?
Yeah.
iStan Turn does all the stuff for us.
So it is friendly?
Yes. Well, it depends. Depend which part you look. If you're looking on the edge side, your iStan Turn actually will learn all your IP addresses during the establishment. Where we actually warning you, if you start, we will not allow you to. If we can do netting, but it depends how you implement. If you're facing edge with the hardware load balancers, we'll ask you to actually to dedicate public IP addresses without doing a netting. But if you're not doing, for example, hardware load balancing, yes, you can freely do the netting. But PAT, well, it's Edge will, during a call establishment, actually the clients will learn all IP addresses. Mm-hmm. That's the whole message. That's what you want to achieve.
Okay.
Has that answered your question?
Kind of.
Can I bribe you?
Question. Question is, so Windows Server 2012 has this capability called Direct Access. For those of you who aren't aware what that is, it essentially allows clients running IPv6. Does it require IPv6?
Yes.
It could be 4 as well. I know internally we use 6.
2010 we don't support
Direct
Access.
I was going to give the quick background. So it basically allows non-VPN connections from your Windows laptop, but have full internal network access over a kind of a secure tunnel using a protocol called Direct Access. With Link Server 2010, we recommend, and we have a way internally that we configure the Direct Access to say media would still flow peer-to-peer, not over the Direct Access tunnel to reduce the number of hops. That guidance would be the same for Link Server 2013. If you have a VPN solution, we recommend split tunneling. That allows media traffic to leave that client and go out the local network connection, whereas your corporate traffic will flow over the either VPN or direct access type solution back internally. So same approach, a similar approach.
So externally, you'd still be using your edge server?
You'd use your edge server to determine your IP address. You may or may not use the edge server as a media relay. So if I'm outside and Voktung's outside and we have direct IP connectivity to each other, which we've discovered by what our external IP address is via edge, we'll send the media path directly. If for some reason I cannot find Voktung's endpoint, right, or Voktung's endpoint is not discoverable, we will relay the media off that edge server external interface. So that's the media path, essentially, for those. Highest number. Anybody over 3,000? Oh, we have, okay, so 3,244. Anybody higher than that? 3,245. Sorry. Any other questions? I kind of jumped the gun a little bit there. One more? 3,461, we're getting higher, all right. So now we'll do equals rand between, and that's D2 and D3. I'm going to push enter and see who the lucky winner is.
My computer. Okay,
I'll hold it. Well, what if I add a ran between D0, or D2, D2, sorry, and D3?
D3, yeah.
All right, let's try that again. No!
Oh, that's a tough
one. Oh, I see. Yes, yes. We got an extra slash in there. Now let's try it.
You push it.
All right. Hey, 1292. Who is closest to 1292? 1289? That's within three. I think we have a winner.
Okay.
All right. That's pretty close. Let's try that again. I think I can just hit enter here. No. There we go. F2 and enter. 2469. 2472. We're really close today. There we go. Anybody closer than three? Oh, wait. Oh, that's you. Okay, sorry. I didn't see where the voice came from. I'm like, oh, someone's within three. You know, it's funny. We haven't had a tie yet where there's two folks within the same distance. And enter. 141. Who's the early registrar? 500? 468? Anybody lower than 468? 431. Sorry, I missed that. 431.
Sold.
Someone got in early on Sunday. And one more?
Yep.
Last one. Oh, sorry, and a backpack.
Yeah.
763.
768.
Within five. 768. All right, there you go.
Yeah, here we go.
And anyone who wants a second backpack will get 711. Hey, it's our Kodak. Randomly came up.
Yeah.
Anybody 7-Eleven? 612? 662? 667?
Come and claim it anyway.
667, there we go. I think 667's got it. All right. Thank you, everyone. Thanks. Fill out your emails.
Okay, no,
appreciate your time. You. Hope you enjoyed Tech Ed.
667, who's 667?
Thank you. You're welcome. Mike.